Welcome to Radical Feminist Perspectives. Today, we are going to hear about the book Women, Church and State by Matilda Jocelyn Gage, discussed by Dorothea Anison. We were hoping to have Sue get in, but she's unwell today and can't come. So fantastically, Dorothea will tell us about the book herself. So thank you so much, Dorothea, and over to you.
Thanks, Jo. Hopefully I'll do the bits that Sue was going to do justice. But anyway, we will try our best. Jo, do you want to put the first slide up, please? Which just shows it gives the cover of the book and a picture of Matilda. As you can see, she lived quite a long life in the 19th century, and she published this book towards the end of her life in 1893. And it really was the sort of culmination of a lifetime's study into the situation of women across history and in different countries of the world. Now, you might be wondering why we're going back to a book that's, nearly 130 years old and why it's relevant. And if we just move on to the next slide, one of the reasons is that writers such as Mary Daly have recognised how important she is. Daly called her a major radical feminist theoretician and historian. And she was very angry, as you can see here, that this knowledge, written with, erudition and passion, had been buried, that she didn't know about it until she did then find out about it and was able to include insights within gynecology, which is where this quote is from. But she's saying we've been kept in ignorance of our own tradition. And she worries that, even as the second wave were publishing books, was this going to happen in the future? And I think we can see some of this happening. I think that, the contribution of the second wave and radical feminists and the ongoing, current contribution isn't always acknowledged as it should be. And that's why this series of webinars is so important. So I wanted to set Daly within a sort of, within radical feminists to show, to show how she does fit in. So can we have the next slide, please? Which is just setting out some of these sources that we used in addition to the actual book, and also how it fits into a number of other books that have been the subject of radical feminist perspectives over the years. And, if you're interested in any of this, you can go back and find out more about it. So gynecology, because it certainly the chapter on witchcraft draws on this. Women of Ideas from Dale Spender, which is an excellent history of the development of feminist thought over time. And we borrowed, we drew on that for the biographical information I'll share in a minute. Sisters in Spirit, which is about the learning of early feminists, including Gage, from Native American women. Books on early times, matriarchy and the development of patriarchy. For a more modern take on religion and how it's impacted women, we have Sheila Jeffries' Man's Dominion, which, covers some of the same stuff but brings it more up to date. And The Spinster and Her Enemies, which is about, other radical feminists at this time. So she does fit into very much into a tradition of thought and action. So just a little bit about her. She, as well as a feminist, she was an abolitionist. Her house was a stop on the Underground Railroad for escaped slaves. She was a defender of Native American rights, adopted into the Wolf Clan of the Mohawk Nation. And she was active in women's rights from the age of 26 and the rest of her life. She was the most radical of the suffrage leaders, but not remembered as much as Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, even though she worked alongside them for many years. She was sidelined and written out of history, which often happens to women that the most radical and challenging, because sometimes other women are scared of that. It's too great a challenge to the patriarchy. There were actually two American suffrage organizations. There was the National, which was led by Gage Stanton and Anthony, which had a radical women's rights agenda, and an American organization, which was Christian in leadership an outlook and was just interested in the vote as a way to get legislation that would support Christian morality. A merger was pushed through between those two organisations against Gage's wishes. She thought it would be disastrous. And she ended up leaving and to establish a new organisation, which was seen, it was attacked by Stanton and Anthony as a secession from the wider women's movement. And of course, what happened was the history, as so often, is written by the victors. And it was written by those who supported the merger. And Gage's contribution wasn't really acknowledged. She was isolated and erased. So she is very much the, you know, the until the second wave feminists rediscovered her, was sort of forgotten about. But she was part of a radical sort of movement of women's rights that were raising all the issues that the second wave raised, that were seen then as new, you know, things like sexual exploitation of women, violence within marriage, all those sorts of things. But it was erased. So if we can have the next slide, please. The aim of the book is very much to show how Christianity, in league with governments, has been damaging for women. You know, she sees it as directly responsible for much of the oppression of women. And so it's an analysis of patriarchy from prehistory through to the 19th century, showing how men and their institutions have systematically oppressed and exploited women. So she gives examples from ancient Egypt through to her contemporary time, and the examples are drawn from many European countries, not just the USA. And I think she may have been the first feminist to actually name the system of oppression as patriarchy. She calls it the patriarchate, but I mean, she's talking about this, you know, the same system where men's institutions are used to oppress women. And she was also one of the first to suggest that there was something prior to the patriarchy, that actually maybe women hadn't always been oppressed, and that Christianity was actually a backward step for women. It was presented as sort of the highest form of civilization, the, you know, the best ever, which it says here, her position had been higher than any before. And she, her aim in this book, which I think she achieves, is to refute that. She explicitly links Christian theology to the legitimation of the exploitation of women, and the way that men as a class profit from women's reproductive and physical labour. That the harder the woman works, the less she gains. So I'm not going to go into the chapter about the matriarchy, because it has been, some of those issues have been covered by more modern feminists in other radical feminist perspectives, and there's a lot of other stuff to go through. So if we go on to slide number 5, which should be the next one, that is her summary of how the church, you know, and she goes back to the development of the early church during the Roman Empire, and then does a lot about how it developed in the Middle Ages, and what was happening, and how a system of oppression was institutionalized. But the basic issue that was that the church used against women is that they are evil and are in league with the devil. So that obviously justified anything you do against them. The church laws that were anti-woman were then built the basis of the development of civil law, the law of states and nations as they developed. She realized that although Christianity claimed to be, have sort of good morals, and that priests were required to be celibate, actually, that was just a cover for a huge sort of system of what she calls organized debauchery, you know, sexual exploitation of women and children, but it was actually like justified by the church. the requirement of confession, which meant that women were supposed to tell all their doings, or even their thoughts, never mind what they'd actually done to priests. Women were forbidden to read the Bible, so were reliant on what men told them about it. The sale of indulgences were basically sort of get out of jail free cards that would wipe away some of your sins, so you could do bad things and get away with it. Heresy, you know, sort of deviation from true religion, was very broadly defined and severely punished. And that, along with the establishment of the Inquisition to root out heretics, was the basis then of the persecution of the witches, which she devotes a chapter to that I'll go on later. So can we have the next slide? It's really interesting that she identifies celibacy, you know, the idea that priests should not have any sexual relationships with women, as one of the key foundations of church oppression of women. Although it was supposed to be about, you know, keeping priests pure, away from sexual temptation and the sinfulness of women, she says that priests were celibate only in name, and in practice they continued to use women and girls sexually, but the women and any children they bore were not entitled to any support. They were illegitimate, i.e. illegal, stigmatized, which kept wealth of the church within the hands of men. And of course we know that the sexual abuse of children within the church has carried on again to the present day, not just in Christianity, in I'm sure in all religions, and has continued to be covered up. So she's very much aware of the double standard of morality, where a man can essentially do what he wants and, you know, use and abuse women as he wills, and it's women that are seen as responsible for this. Women are the ones that are punished. Women are the ones that have to support the children that result from that, without any sort of thing happening to the man. So that's the organized system of debauchery. And then just general sort of prohibitions against women, restrictions on their behavior. Women weren't allowed to approach the altar. There was rules on what they could wear. They weren't allowed to speak in church. And that Latin bit at the end of the slide is, you know, as you can probably guess, it's really, you know, referring to menstruation, the idea that women that are menstruating are impure or dirty in some way, and therefore not fit to take part in the church service. So it's basically linking to the idea that women don't really have a soul, that we're not really human, which I think is what's playing out in a lot of the current attack on women's rights, that we're just not seen as real people with real existence and real rights. We can just have them sort of trampled over. And the silencing of women's voices, which again, you know, we saw a, you know, absolute classic example of yesterday in New Zealand. And also having imitation women. You know, they wouldn't have women singing in church, so they would either have boys pre-puberty to give the high voices, or actually having eunuchs. You know, there was a whole tradition of actually castrating men so that they could carry on singing the high notes. And of course the priests wear dresses, you know, so they get rid of the real women and have imitation women. But one of the things she does point out, that there are glimmers of hope, and, you know, once this question, because the religious system of you know, convents and abbeys did allow some women to get power, you know, to sort of be quite autonomous in running an organization of, you know, a house of women, with women, and some of them even were mixed sex, but with the female in charge, and we hear of women like Hildegard of Bingen, who was very sort of learned and creative woman, and but there are other ones as well. Can we have the next one, please? Next slide. So it's just a sort of summary here of how church and the state combined to keep women inferior. Women were inferior and therefore they were subordinated. Sons inherited property before daughters, and that kept all the money and property and wealth in the hands of men. which helped keep women in a subordinate condition. One of her key insights is that it's lack of education and lack of property that have kept women down, kept them powerless. And their lack of that is not an accident, it is a deliberate decision by men within the church and in the state. And can I have the next one, please? Right. Right. She then has a chapter that she calls Marquette, which is a word that isn't well known today, but essentially the chapter is all about sexual exploitation and abuse of women and children. The actual Marquette refers to the feudal period in Europe when lords basically had total control over the serfs, both men and women. But the women had a particularly raw deal because not only did they have to do the hard labour in the fields and agriculture, they were also subject to sexual abuse. The lord had the right to have, to rape women as he would, there would be no comeback because she was totally powerless. And that even extended to an idea that on a woman, the night that a woman was marrying, she should actually be taken by the lord, the lord of the manor, the duke, first, before the man she was actually marrying. And she identifies that this exploitation by powerful men against women carries on into her own time. And she basically accuses aristocratic and royal men of her own time of involvement in child sexual exploitation. Of course, we know that goes on now. We've had Epstein, the involvement of Prince Andrew in that, and I'm sure many, many, many other men that we don't know about. And then she brings that up to date by saying that this has been the foundation of all sexual exploitation of women. It's just a continuous tradition. And she recognises that this is the basis, or one of the basis, of male controlling of women. So she says, the woman of every Christian land fears to meet a man in a secluded place by day or night, which is still what we have to reckon. We don't feel that we can freely go where we want to, when we want to. We are aware that we're at risk. And then men escape all punishment because men alone enact the laws, which is obviously why they were fighting for the vote. But we know that getting the vote enough alone isn't enough, that men are still in charge. The laws, they may have improved since her time. Some of the things that we have laws against, rape in marriage, for instance, that didn't exist in her time, but they're not really very well enforced. Please don't take rape seriously, etc. And so it's the results of a system of teaching which declares woman a being which was divinely created for the use and sensual gratification of men. She's very direct. Sometimes her language can be a little unclear because she doesn't actually name things like child sexual exploitation or rape. It's more elusive. But then sometimes she just comes out and says something really direct like that. The church sees women as just there for men to use sexually, which is very blunt. And she links that to, as I said, to prostitution in her own time. That still carries on. The state is involved in it. She refers to the feminist campaign in Britain against the Contagious Diseases Act, which was used against women who were suspected of being involved in prostitution, with nothing done against the men. And she actually identifies that the growth of women's ability to work and earn a living actually meant that fewer women were sort of forced into prostitution. And so there was more forcible trafficking. She gives the example, excuse me, of women in the USA at her time who were kidnapped to be taken to remote rural lumber camps and mines for sexual abuse and were subject to extreme violence. So if we could go on to the next slide, this is related to her chapter on witchcraft, which is it's very interesting. It is a feminist analysis of the witch persecutions, which Mary Daly described as learned and revolutionary. And she sees very clearly that the persecution of women as witches is part of the church attempt to control and punish women. And although previous pagan religions believed in witchcraft, Christianity was unique in seeing the women as the most susceptible. Because women were seen as weak and inherently sinful, they were more vulnerable to temptation. And the church witch hunters had a saying that there's one wizard to 10,000 witches. So they went out, you know, deliberately looking for women as the evil, the ones in league with the devil. And she does see, Gage is very clear that the hunting and burning of witches is primarily an attack on women as women. She says, for witches, read women. And she links it to the possession of knowledge by women. So women having knowledge, for instance, of herbs that could be used, you know, for healing the sick, but also to control reproduction, you know, as either contraceptions or to help abortion. She sees, you know, that she, like Daly, she likes to excavate the meanings of words and show that some of the meanings have been distorted over time. So a vast amount of evidence exists to show that the word witch formerly signified a woman of superior knowledge. And few women dared to be wise after thousands of their sex had been done to death by drowning or burning because of their knowledge. And she sees the witch persecution as part of an attack upon science at the hands of the church. She's very critical of the church. It's actually been anti-science, anti-education, wanting to deliberately keep all people, but particularly women, ignorant on the basis that knowledge is power. And she says she gives very detailed historical accounts of the persecution, torture, an execution of millions, you know, possibly millions of women. And she doesn't shy away from the details of it, the use of torture. And so the procedures were just complete, it's a catch 22. So a woman might be tied up and thrown in a river. If she drowned, it proved she was innocent. If she survived, it was proof that she'd used witchcraft, and so she would be taken off and burnt at the stake. So whatever happened, you were done for. Once she'd had that accusation of witchcraft had been made, it was, you know, almost impossible to escape from it. Even things like looking, you know, whether or not you looked at somebody in the face was seen as indication of guilt at witchcraft. But she points out the church had taught women to keep a downcast look because of they should be ashamed of bringing sin into the world. To this day, an open and confident look upon a woman's face is deprecated as evil. And so there were travelling witch inquisitors journeying from country to country in search of victims of torture and death, regarded with more fear than famine or pestilence. But the witch hunts were also a means to enrich the church, because the woman who was damned as a witch, her property, yeah, any property she had and her family would be seized. She sees it, she recognises that older women were particularly vulnerable, and suggests that maybe accusing somebody of being a witch was a way to get rid of an unwanted wife, you know, a man that wanted to sort of get another woman because he didn't like the one that he had, or that she was no longer of sexual interest or use to him. And we need to remember that this isn't just of historical interest. I mean, in some countries such as Ghana and India, women can still be accused of witchcraft, leading to their, you know, murder, at worst, at best, ostracization from families and communities. And of course, we know that the idea of a witch hunt, of targeting a woman, accusing her unfairly, persecuting her, is used against feminists that speak up. You know, J.K. Rowling and others, and you know, some less famous women have been punished by losing their jobs, that sort of thing. So she says the persecution of the witchcraft period was but a continuation of church policy, that of universal domination over the lives, the property and the thoughts of mankind. So if we move on to the next slide, please. After this, she note that chapter, she goes on to talking about her own time, the late 19th century. Still, she still puts historical information into it, but this is very much moving into the more into the current position of women in the 19th century to show how little had changed in what was supposedly more enlightened times, that sexual abuse and exploitation through work, through marriage, the oppression of women by men continues. That there was actually not as much change as many in the church like to claim. So she's very critical of Christian marriage. The teaching of the church was that Christian marriage was better than what had gone previously, and she challenges that. She sort of talks about what was going on in Roman times and sort of ancient Hindu laws, things like that, that gave women more rights of property. So she's very clear that under the Christian form of marriage, a wife surrenders her person, her property, and her conscience into the control of her husband. And this is justified by the Bible, that sees woman as being made for man, secondary to man, under his authority, and that is justified by God. So any woman that challenges that is actually challenging the divine command of the Almighty. And she's very clear that women are treated as property within marriage. So quote here that a wife was taken from her own family and transferred to her husband as a piece of property. She assumed his name, the same as a slave took that of the new master. And she also refers to how daughters were seen by men, you know, particularly rich and powerful men, as a way of getting more property. So you'd marry your daughter off to somebody that has some advantage to your family, be that a political influence or more property or whatever. And throughout most of the time, women had very little, or certainly women of the middle and upper classes had very little say in who they would marry. And so she sums it up. The condition of women during 1800 years of Christianity, legislated for as slaves, that they didn't have any rights of their own, imprisoned for crimes that if committed by a man were only punished by branding, buried alive for other crimes that men could atone for by the payment of a fine, denied a share in the government of the family or the church, their very sex deemed a curse. It says, the 20th century is now about to open, showing no truly enlightened nation upon the face of the earth. So contrary to the sort of feelings of the time that there was progress, that things were getting better and better, she was very clear that no, they weren't for women. And one of the things she identifies, if we can have the next one, Sue was going to do this bit, so I will not be doing it as possibly as well as her, but she quotes a list of rules for the government of my wife's conduct from 1879 from a Mr. Davenport. And I think the rules, there was a divorce case, and these rules had been shared in this, which is why she had it. And so it gives a whole list of things that she cannot do while she seems to be going on a trip to family in New York. She's not allowed to speak to anybody. She's got to go to a certain place and be only there and, keep away from people. I mean, I've just sort of copied the first three. There were seven rules in total, and it all says you can't go here, you can't speak to anybody. The only people you can see is your brother, I think it was. And what she's identified is very clearly coercive control. She doesn't name it as that. It wasn't sort of conceptualized as that. And Sue was going to read out some rules from a book that was published this century that had where a man had a set of rules for his wife that she had to obey, starting with vacuuming the living room daily, and again went on to what she could, how she could spend her time, where she could go, that sort of thing. So she's very clear that marriage is not good for women. It's not beneficial to her, to us. And the increase of rights in the 19th century is an illusion. You know, although there'd been some changes in law in the laws in America for things like property, it had made very, very little difference. And she actually gives some examples of the cruel treatment of women, and certainly around the fact that assaults by a husband on a wife were not taken seriously. So she gives an example of lenient sentences that a man accused of injuring his wife was given a £1 fine. At the same court on the same day, a man accused of damaging a bench was fined £2. So, you know, a woman is worth half of a bench. And you know, it then goes on to some of the stuff that I won't go into in detail about how, you know, women didn't even have any control over their children. They could lose custody. They didn't have any sort of say in how they would be educated or named or anything like that, that women had no right to question their husbands, you know, that he had could have total control over her property, but she had no right to question what he did or how he spent his money. You know, she gave an example from a court case where a woman had tried to challenge the fact that her husband was spending all the money that was supposed to be for the family on fancy dinners out and going, you know, all the best clothes to wear and everything like that. Just frittering it away, essentially, leaving her with not enough to maintain the house and the children. And basically the judge, she was trying to get a divorce, said, well, that's just the way it is. You know, it's his money. He can do what he likes with it. And your job as a wife is just to make the best of what he allows you to have. So it was, you know, still very, very much women powerless, women just completely under the control of a woman. And she even gives examples of women that had left husbands, you know, that had moved away to try and start a new life, and they were actually forced to return. The court said, no, you don't have any right to go and leave. This is, you know, whatever he's done to you isn't sufficient. He's not, you know, there were some rights to divorce and separation on grounds of cruelty, but the you know, level of cruelty you had to prove was very high. And, you know, violence wasn't necessarily grounds for it. Those restrictive rules that I mentioned weren't enough of a ground for it. Not giving, you know, depriving you of money wasn't enough grounds for it. So she is very anti-marriage, doesn't see it as any kind of advantage for women. And then she goes on to talk about women's work, both paid work and domestic labour. I can slow down, I think. I've just had a look at the time and we've still got quite a lot of time. So sorry if I've been speaking too quickly. I think that's something that I tend to do. I worry about the time. So if we could go on to the next slide, and then we'll be talking about women and work. So one of the talents of Gage is that she her skill is to study the Bible and know the Bible better than the men. And so when they say, oh, you know, the Bible justifies this treatment of women, or the Bible says that this has to happen, she challenges this by better knowledge of the Bible. She turns it back on them and knows it better than they do. And one of the fundamental justifications that the Bible gave for the oppression of women was what was known as the curse of Eve. So I don't know, you know, I'll just go through it for, you know, women that aren't familiar with the Bible. But in the Garden of Eden, there was, you know, Adam and Eve, and they were told that they shouldn't eat the fruit of a particular tree, the knowledge of good and evil, I think it was called. Eve was tempted by a serpent and disobeyed, and she ate the apple and shared it with Adam. And for that, Adam and Eve were cast out of the Garden of Eden, and they were both cursed. The curse of Eve was to be subject to Adam, that she had to obey him, and also that she would bear children in pain and suffering. So the idea that, childbirth was painful was God's punishment. And that was often, this was used to remind women of their inferior status and responsibility for all the sin in the world. But she reminds her readers that Adam was also cursed, and that is obviously, forgotten about. And his curse was to do all the work of the world, his labour was to labour in the fields. And so she says, if you're going to take the Bible literally, women should actually be exempt from any work except childbearing, because Adam is meant to do the work, Eve bears the children. And one of the things the church used this curse of Eve to justify was opposition to any use of anaesthetics to relieve any, women's pain in labour. Because this was the time when anaesthetics were starting to be developed, and the church was condemning this as, interfering with God's punishment, that women had to be subject to their husbands, desire them, and labour in pain. She says, logically, if they wanted to be against any alleviation of women's curse, then it should surely protest any attempts to relieve men's labour. But the idle rich are respected more than labourers. And in fact, of course, men make women work incredibly hard in agriculture and industry, as well as domestic work, but they don't get the benefit of it. And the church doesn't object to this. The only time there's any objection to women working is when they want to encroach on the male monopolies of high paid and professional work. So she's clear that men, with the backing of the church, use and exploit women in our labour to enrich themselves. And she actually describes it as a universally extended form of domestic slavery. And then she gives an incredible amount of evidence of the nature of women's oppression through work. In countries around the world, she doesn't just concentrate on the UK and the USA. She gives examples from Russia, from Switzerland, Sweden, Belgium. She's done an incredibly amount of research. And one of the things that we wanted to share was this, which is the testimony of women workers. And she's taken this from a report that was done in Britain. About women that were working in the coal mines in the north of England, and the hardship that they went under. I mean, they were literally chained to sort of small wagons and pulled these from the coal face up to the surface, going on their hands and feet with a chain around their, between their legs. A steep road, very wet, the water comes over our clog tops. 17-year-old having a bald patch on her head because of having to use her head to do things. And, it just gives an example of how badly women are treated. And she contrasts this with Christianity's claim to protect women and respect women, and that, women had a special place. It's very much, she realises that only applies to middle class women, that working class women are just, used for their labour. She gives other examples of rural women as well. I mean, she doesn't just look at the, industrial work, that rural women do incredibly hard and heavy labour. Again, they have to carry heavy loads. They can be harnessed to carts. They dig, they harvest. They're treated as beasts of burden. And of course, she points out that unlike men, they also have to do the domestic work. So although men may work hard, they might get some rest at the end of the day. The woman doesn't, because she has to make sure he has his food, and she has to attend to the children. Do the laundry, all the things we know. And, this has become a custom for women to do all that, and then that becomes an unwritten law or even a moral command. So women are just expected to do all this without any complaint. And she goes back to saying, if Adam's curse to labour was taken seriously, this should be men's work. Women are cursed to bring children into the world in sorrow. There is nothing said about rearing them. And she's very clear that women that do work are not paid enough to survive. And she makes the link to women ending up in prostitution, that they can't make enough money to support themselves by the wages they're allowed. She's very clear that male workers in trade unions will act against the interests of women workers. They will preserve their own rights and privileges. And this even goes to such petty things as denying armrests to pottery painters. So it wasn't just keeping women's wages low or excluding them from the trades that were more skilled and highly paid. You know, they couldn't even have a rest, or they managed to exclude women from cheaper workers' fares that were offered on some trams. So women's wages were never enough to live on. So they were forced to be dependent on husbands and families. Most of them had no choice but to stay with a man, however bad things were. And many male employers sexually abused their workers. And older women in particular, she said, found it almost impossible to secure any form of employment, being forced into the workhouse at best, and slow starvation or suicide at the worst. And so she's clear that this is because men are seen as owning the labour and services of their wives and daughters. And this is backed up by the church and the state. A husband could take any money that his wife earned, and she was obliged to do the domestic labour without payment, but she had no claim on any of his resources. She was very much dependent on what he chose to give her. But she just contrasts the heavy labour of the modern American woman with the life of the Native American women. As I said at the beginning, she was familiar with the nations that were sort of in the area of New York that she lived in. And she said that the women there were much better off. They didn't have to work as hard. They had more power. There was a council of women that had some decision-making power. So how are we doing? So if we go on to the next slide. She then sort of goes on to what the church is doing against women in the 19th century. Although she does a lot of historical work, she doesn't want it to be seen as though things have changed or have got better. She accuses them as much as anybody else. And one of the things she suggests is that women are not sufficiently aware of the meaning of personal liberty or the causes of their restricted condition. And they're constrained by customs, laws and morality, and they lack property or education, and both are a source of power. So that's definitely one of her sort of things that she sees as needing to happen, is that women become educated, that they abandon self-sacrifice, which has been what women have been expected to do, for self-development, for sort of understanding their own capabilities, their own capacity, and then so one of the things she is very critical of her contemporary church for is being against education for women. This time women weren't allowed into universities. They weren't allowed to study things like medicine or law, and the church was against that. So with medical opinion, they would say that women's brains couldn't cope with it, or it would damage their reproductive organs if they had to think too much. And of course, since women are only there to have children, that was a bad thing. So she's got in deprecating education for women, no organised body in the world has so clearly proven its own tyrannous ignorance as had the priesthood. and no body has shown itself so fully the enemy of mankind. And she says that this, you know, restriction of education, the, you know, destruction of the knowledge of the so-called witches, have actually physically damaged women as well as, you know, mentally, subjugated her spirit and crushed her belief in her right to herself and the proper training of her children. So she sees it as, you know, the whole patriarchal system of men's institutions acting for and behalf of men as just a bit utterly and totally damaging to women. And I like this one as well. The church, in its opposition to women's education through the ages, has literally killed off the inhabitants of the world with much greater rapidity than war, pestilence, or famine. More than one half of the children born into the world have soon died because of the tyranny and ignorance of the priesthood. Because, of course, at that time, there was a tremendous infant mortality rate. Many women, many children didn't survive, you know, beyond the first sort of months or years of life. And that is because of the priests, because they damaged knowledge, they denied women education, so they didn't, you know, they weren't able even to you know, keep their children well. So where are we now? I'm just checking out. Didn't everything. So we have her conclusions, some of the things on the final slide that we've got here. Her final chapter is called Past, Present and Future. And she has some lovely sort of summing up. The most stupendous system of organised robbery known has been that of the church towards women. A robbery that has not only taken her self-respect, but all rights of person, the fruits of her own industry, her opportunities of education, the exercise of her own judgment, her own conscience, her own will. So she, you know, she's very clear of the damage that the church and then all the other institutions. I mean, she very much concentrates on the church, which was still powerful at that time. But that's why it's called woman, church and state, that the state laws just still reflect this view of women. And so are her conclusions useful to us today? I would say yes. I've learned a lot from reading this book. It's, you know, that there's an excellent analysis of how men control institutions. They're run by men for men and are used to oppress women. It's a good radical feminist framework, because she realizes that there's needs for fundamental change, not just some laws for equal rights, you know, that the society as it is currently structured is actively organizing against women. And that's not just all this. She concentrates on church or on state. She also then takes that into the private realm of marriage and the family, that those institutions have been set up in such a way that it oppresses women. And actually challenging marriage and religion in this way at the time was very radical. You know, as I said at the beginning, it was too much for some you know, more conservative feminists, and that's why she was pushed out and forgotten. So she, you know, we need fundamental change, not just some laws for equal rights. Women are not recognised as fully human. And again, she emphasises the importance of women's personal development and free thought, because one of the things that obviously the church did was to say, this is the truth, we have the truth, you know, nobody can think, you know, anything else is heresy, we'll wipe it out. You know, she says women need to stop being the scapegoat of humanity, reject the idea that we're inferior, in need of protection, in favour of freedom, and to seek educational and political rights. And she says, but woman is learning for herself, not self-sacrifice, but self-development is her first duty in life. And her final words, which I've put on here, the second part of this quote is, During the ages, no rebellion has been of like importance with that of woman against the tyranny of church and state. None has had its far-reaching effects. We note its beginning. Its progress will overthrow every existing form of these institutions. Its end will be a regenerated world. So I just made me think, if only she had been listened to, if only this had been a sort of handbook for women over the last 100 years, we may have made a bit more progress than we have done. But it's certainly, I found it a very inspiring book and very fascinating in terms of what it covers. So it is actually available freely online if you search. I meant to post the link, but because I ended up doing it on my own, I forgot to do that. But if you Google Women, Church and State, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, you will find it online and you can download it. So that is the end of the presentation, and I'm going to hand you over to Jo.
I'm going to join in now because you're coughing.
Thank you. And I shall look at the chat and any...
And I'm also going to see if possibly Sheila Jeffries or Marin Rotigliano, who have both been here in the background, would like to come in. And if you would, maybe just open your videos and I'll pin you and get you to come on. Yeah, great. That would be really good. So I'm adding Sheila Jeffries as a spotlight and Marion. And if you both unmute yourselves, then we could perhaps have, we've got about 10 minutes or 8 minutes left. Let's see. So Sheila, have you got any thoughts on the book?
Yes. I didn't know about the book, though. I was just trying to look up when it was first published. When was your copy published, Dorothea?
I don't know, because I've got an online. 1893, it was on my first slide.
I mean republished. I guess I mean republished in Second Wave Feminism.
Right, I don't know, because I didn't. I couldn't find a physical copy at a reasonable price. So.
I've just been looking up, because I think in the 70s, when I first became a feminist, I didn't know about this book, and it probably was not until it was republished, because basically she's talking about all the things we talked about in Second Wave Feminism. So, I mean, extraordinary stuff, as I said in the chat, absolutely extraordinary that women still take slave names when they marry. I mean, and women are slaves. I mean, marriage is obviously about slavery, as she points out, and feminists did in the Second Wave. And also, of course, as I pointed out in Spinster and Her Enemies, there were women a bit like her in the UK. There was a Cicely Hamilton, who was a spinster and wrote Marriage as a Trade in the first decade of the 20th century, who makes many of these points and says it's just unpaid labour and so on. And there was Winifred Wolstenholme Elmy, who at the end of the 19th century in Britain was refusing to marry the man that she was then forced to marry because she was in the anti-prostitution campaign, and they wouldn't accept her unless she married, and she was very critical of marriage as well. So I think what Second Wave feminists didn't know in the beginning, and many people don't know now, is that there was a massive campaign by spinsters and against marriage and to criticize religion and to criticize marriage at that time. It was common, but obviously, as you pointed out, Matilda was to the extreme of this and was not acceptable because of that. But there were women in Britain who were just as critical. It's an absolutely terrific book. And the way, as you say, that we just get disappeared from history regularly over and over and over again is awful, really, because it's all the same themes all the way through. Really, really is. Marriages still exist. I mean, marriage not only exists, but there are lesbians doing it and talking about having wives. I mean, incredible. 130 years on, and there are people who still don't realize marriage is a form of slavery in which men possess women. I mean, that's incredible, really. Even some women who call themselves feminists. Absolutely incredible. Anyway, I'll leave it there.
How about you, Marion? What did you get from it? I mean, it was brilliant. But
I'm glad you did this. This is kind of a follow-up on a book we did a couple of weeks ago called Sisters in Spirit, about Matilda Jocelyn Gage and Elizabeth Cady Stanton in 1848, middle of nowhere upstate New York, and the first, women's convention. And it's by the same author, Sally Roche Wagner. And she talked about and quoted these early writings, even then, from Matilda Joslyn Gage, about the effect on religion of women. And it's all religions. It's the three Abrahamic religions, and we could debate which one's worse and which one that's worse by women, but it's all cut from the same cloth. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the Abrahamic religions. You can go to supposedly enlightened religions anywhere in the world, and there's pretty significant misogyny and, you know, concomitantly homophobia, lesbophobia. But I think what's really telling is that when women first started thinking, you know, back in 1848 or even before that, when women first started thinking, at least in the US, about why women are in the position we're in and how we are oppressed, one of the first things that one of the best thinkers came up with is that religion plays a huge role in the oppression of women. And she, I remember quotes from Matilda Joslyn Gage from that other book, talking about how, you know, patriarchy couldn't exist without religion and religion couldn't exist without patriarchy because they are the same thing. And religions, especially the ones that have men being subservient rather than in a loving relationship with a god, this is really damaging to, like, you know, male ego and male socialization. So the way they cope with it is by then being oppressive to, you know, some lesser form of life, which is always women. So this is even before, 73. Back in 1848, Matilda Joslyn Gage knew. She knew. She was one of the first.
Yeah, I mean, I'll add also a thing that really upsets me is that when academics today teach feminism, they certainly to schools, but also I think at university level, the standard understanding is that the suffragettes were middle class white women who were only interested in the vote in a simplistic way, thinking that the vote was and in their own liberation, and that they didn't have any conception of anything else, and they were racist. That's how they're taught. And then they say the second wave added on some of the, you know, radical feminist ideas about sexuality, and then the brilliance of the postmodernist intersectional 1990s, where they actually sort of chastised the bad women that all came before for being racist and right wing and middle class. And it's just such nonsense. And I think this is wonderful that you've dispelled all of that in this, you know, bringing Joslyn Gage, Matilda Joslyn Gage back into our consciousness. And hopefully lots of us will read it. I'm certainly going to read it now. Well, we've got 2 minutes left, so yeah. Maybe back to you, Dorothea.
Yeah, well, just to say, yeah, I mean, thank you. I've enjoyed reading it. I'm having a quick look at the chat, and then, you know, it seems to have got lots of ideas going. So, yeah, I just thank you, everybody, for coming and listening.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks, everybody. Thanks for being here. There are some breakout rooms if you want to go next week. We have Sonia Johnson. Is it, what's the name of it, Marion? Fire?
Wildfire.
Wildfire. Wildfire. By Sonia Johnson, discussed by Marion Rutiliano. So thanks so much this week to everybody, and especially Dorothea.
Thank you.
Bye.